Well, hello everyone. Thanks again for downloading this episode of the podcast. I'm really happy that I managed to get a second one out so quickly after our last discussion with Simon Benjamin. And I'm delighted today to have on Will Zeng, who is the head of Quantum Cloud Services at Rigetti Quantum Computing in California. So, Will, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Simon. Appreciate it.
So first of all, let's just go over a little bit about yourself, how you got into quantum, what motivated you to study this, and how you ended up at a place like Rigetti, arguably the first quantum startup to build an actual quantum computer.
Yeah, great. Yeah, no, I'd be happy to talk about it. I think one of the things that's fun about quantum computing and quantum information in general is that people come at it from so many different angles. You know, some of them start in everything from computer science to philosophy or to electrical engineering or something like this. But for me, I actually really grew up in the field. So I think the first I heard about quantum computing was that old Scientific American article that Scott Aronson wrote about the limits of computers. And it was sort of from that theoretical computer science angle that I kind of got my interest piqued. And the special initial thing that got me interested in quantum was that it has two characteristics that are very rare. Those are the first is that you can work on something that's very, you know, very foundational. And the foundational aspect of quantum information is that, you know, we're realigning the relationship between physics and information theory, really. I think the realization that the laws of physics don't just limit what we could imagine to build, you know, as computational machines, as mathematical machines, but actually are more creative than us. In some ways, you know, the quantum physics allows us to build types of computers that we had and different kinds of models for computers than we had imagined in a vacuum that kind of are different than the traditional model. You know, changes the relationship between physics and information, and that was very, very fascinating. So it's got this deep foundational aspect to it, and you know, things about the extended Church-Turing thesis and all this stuff are related to this. And on the other side, while working on that same deep foundational problem, you're also trying to build technology to help people. And you have the potential that those are actually the same kind of work. This is totally rare. There's really not a lot of stuff that's like this. I mean, maybe fusion power is like a little bit, but like I would contend that, you know, quantum information is much more foundational than the physics of fusion power. So
You might
it's,
get some pushback on that one.
you know, I'll take that pushback. I'll take that pushback. You know, that's why I'm in quantum. And so those two aspects and the chance to work on that really appealed to me. And so, so when I was looking at, you know, where to go for undergrad, I got lucky enough to kind of find out about the superconducting qubit groups and the works that was going on at Yale with Michel Devoret and Rob Schoelkopf and Steve Girvan's groups all working together, and just sort of started hanging out there as an undergrad, learning everything I could, and you know, taking courses with Michel at grad courses that it's very kind of him to let me into and to learn about quantum noise quite early. And then I spent a little bit of time tuning up 2-qubit gates in Andreas Wallraff's group at ETH in undergrad. And so what I didn't realize, but what I did realize is that, you know, these were small. This was around the you know, 2007 to 2010 period. And there were quantum bits that, like, I as an undergrad could tune up. I could run small. Realize how far ahead some of that technology was compared to the rest of the world, especially this stuff happening in superconducting qubits. But it led me to the conclusion that, you know, at some point we're going to be able to build a gate model quantum computers out of superconducting qubits or some of these similar other kinds of flavors. It's just kind of a matter of time.
So
And so then, yeah, go ahead.
you were twinking, you've been in labs. You're not a theorist like me who's not allowed anywhere near this equipment.
No, that's right. Yeah, no, not quite. Yeah, so I've been in labs. And I actually did it. And then I also, when I came to Rigetti, I was like back in labs as well, which we'll get to. So yeah, I mean, my trajectory kind of goes up and down the whole stack of quantum computing. And so starting in superconducting qubits, you know, not, you know, just as the undergrad learning and seeing all this stuff get invented. This was like I kind of joined the lab like right after the transmon was kind of an idea. Like the JPC was something people were talking about. I was just learning. And the thing that came to mind was it looks like these systems are going to be scaled up and we're going to have hardware. What are we going to do with them? Becomes the question. And you know, at that time, it was like, well, we've got the Grover's tricks, which are basically amplitude amplification, and we've got like hidden subgroup problem classes and everything related to that, and these algebraic problems. But it wasn't clear that we knew how to answer the question of what problems can quantum physics let us solve faster at a pretty high level. And so I ended up doing my PhD in computer science at Oxford in quantum algorithms in Bob Cook and Samson Abramsey's group. Mm-hmm. And there they take a very high, this is like the opposite end of the spectrum of like engineering superconducting qubits. It's like the opposite side of quantum information theory.
Yeah.
So they use a part of mathematics called category theory and categorical algebra to study processes. And the idea is to try and generalize beyond quantum mechanics, to try and understand the parts of quantum mechanics that are actually letting us do different kinds of computations faster. Like, what is it? You know, is it entanglement? Is it complementary variables? Is it these kind of observables? Like, is it contextuality? Like, what are the structures in the mathematics of quantum mechanics that actually let us do things faster and better?
So I'm going to put you on the spot here and say, what is it?
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
it's a great question.
You've done an entire PhD on what makes quantum computing more powerful. I expect you should be able to give an answer now.
I know, right? Mm. No, I can't give one answer. I can tell you, there's a whole chapter in my thesis where I was just trying to figure out why the Fourier transform comes up naturally in quantum mechanics. So it's basically because the Fourier transform is something that appears very naturally because of complementarity in a particular way. And so that these things are actually linked. So if you give me a theory, not just quantum mechanics, but you give me some, and this is like the mathematical aspect. We didn't just study quantum theory. We studied this generalized class of things called process theories. But if you give me a theory that has some kind of structure similar to complementarity, then you should be able to do something like a Fourier transform very naturally and very quickly in it. So that link, like, took many years, but I was able to nail down a little bit in the PhD and also kind of use some of these higher level tools to look at different kinds of black box algorithms. So there's like a couple group theoretic algorithms that I worked on, some generalizations of quantum secret sharing protocols based on these generalized abstractions. And so I really went to the kind of the opposite side of quantum to look at kind of that deep foundational aspect. And so while I was there, a few lucky things happened, I guess. One was superconducting qubits trajectory did continue, as it looked like it might. You know, fidelities continued to get better. Some of these 3D transmons that IBM was working on, and Chad was working on, who I work with every day now, started to get high enough fidelity to be around the threshold for the service code, let's say.
Right.
And then the other thing that happened was that some of these what I now call hybrid quantum classical algorithms started to emerge. And you know, these are algorithms that don't require millions of fault-tolerant fully error-corrected qubits, but can run on, I think the term now is NISC devices, noisy intermediate scale quantum computers.
Preskill has really started just coining stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to give him another at bat after quantum supremacy. Because, right. Like, that, you know, let's take another try. Try this shot. Like, that one, not great. So my thought was, you know, okay, we're going to need to know what to do with these machines. Like, maybe I should take a step back and look at the mathematics of quantum mechanics and, like, try and come up with a better language for talking about computational aspects of a physical theory in general. And while this was interesting and like sort of worked, like didn't lead to like a breakthrough in how to do something in the near term, like that was come up with by other people, you know, like Jared McLean and Alice Beruguzic's group, and the variational quantum eigensolver being the example first, and then the quantum approximate optimization algorithm being like maybe the next pillar one, and there's sort of a lot of other from FRE and a lot of other work that kind of happened meant that two doors had sort of opened. The first door being, okay, superconducting qubits might scale. And the second door being, there might be something to run that doesn't require a million fault-tolerant qubits, or, well, a million physical qubits with fault.
Let me just step back for a second and just ask a question on this, because it is something that people are still sort of debating, and whether or not people quite understand it or not. So this near-term noisy intermediate quantum stuff. This is about not running error correction protocols, which are resource intensive and costly and therefore require millions of qubits. So it's what can be done without error correction. So just to give a bit of a background before I ask the question, everyone is talking about these quantum supremacy protocols, whether you like the name or not. And the rough estimate is that you need about 50 qubits that can run about 40 gate steps. So in the context of these other algorithms that you're mentioning, variational eigensolvers, QAOA, these kind of algorithms, are they really, you know, the same kind of scale? Are they also really, really small algorithms so that we could imagine running them without error correction? Or are we still running into problems of the fact that, you know, they are still a little bit big? They're not as big as factoring. They're not as big as quantum chemistry. But they are going to require a little bit of error correction unless we can drop error rates substantially in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's still an open question. I think there's been some surprising results about what you can do with, you know, 5 to 10 gates or 40 gates. But when you do the kind of straightforward thing, if you just sort of look at the traditional ansatzes for VQE and look at how they scale, it's still, you know, maybe thousands of gates, not millions of gates. You know, some of these algorithms for fault tolerant ones, like if you look at Shor's, you know, you're looking at 10 to the 14 gates or something like that, like these astronomically huge numbers.
Yeah.
So what these hybrid algorithms do in certain cases is move that down to some, at least within several orders of magnitude of what we can do now. And then the hope is we can do two things. We can both improve the fidelities we have today, one. Start to find problem instances and come up with clever algorithmic techniques to shrink what's required for these hybrid algorithms. Because, you know, the straightforward ansatzes are probably not going to be the ones that we actually use in practice for particular instances. Like, it's going to be very specific application-tuned circuits. And if we can find, you know, factors of 2, factors of 3, factors of 10, then that can make a really big difference here. The other thing that's worth mentioning is I don't think about NISQ devices as being where there's no error correction only.
Right.
It's where there's where basically you have I think of it more as you have to pay attention to the errors a lot, which is, I know, a very like vague way of talking about it, but that's because I believe error correction will be not a step change, but will be sort of slowly turned on over time. You know, you're gonna be able to make trade-offs to say, okay, I want to use these qubits for computation, and then I want to use these qubits in a small distance code. I'm sorry, is that dinging for you? Maybe. I want to use some qubits for computation, and then others I want to encode at this distance, and others I want to encode at this distance, and in this code, and maybe you make trade-offs of what code you use in different parts, and there's going to be this kind of mid-range where even if we can do the classical control and feedback, you're going to have to make a choice as to whether or not you use your limited number of qubits for overhead for QEC and how much, or if you use it for more computation. I count that as part of NISQ. And so that kind of third pillar is, so the first pillar is make the physical computer, the physical fidelity better. The second pillar is do algorithmic tricks on specific instances, which I think, you know, there's a lot of low hanging fruit there and would really encourage a lot of people to work on it. And the third is to slowly turn on error correction. And I think that's how we're going to make the best, you know, at bat to try and get these near-term applications running.
Right, right. So, I mean, you started out tinkering in the lab. You then went to Oxford to work with Bob on the much more high-level theoretical work on quantum algorithms and quantum information processing. And then after you left Oxford, correct me if I'm wrong, but then you decided to move into the private sector.
Yeah. So I knew of Chad because Chad had been in Michelle's group. He was a second graduate student in Michelle's group. And I was sort of the lowly undergrad. He was like the postdoc finishing up. So we didn't know each other that well, but, you know, I knew his background and I saw that he went into Y Combinator right when I was starting to, kind of the year before I was thinking of finishing. And so I got in touch with him. I came out and we didn't have to talk about the technology that he was building. Like, I knew already, like, you're making supergenetic qubits. Like, I know the state of the field. And it was him and just, you know, somebody else at that time, just kind of working on getting it going. And worth remembering, because it wasn't that long ago, is nobody was starting quantum startups in, you know, 2014. And this was that summer. You know, when you say quantum startup, everyone said, you know, they knew of some Canadian company. and and not anything else, right?
Yeah, some Canadian company.
And it's totally different now. Like, I think I, you know, I was in Bilbao for a conference a few weeks ago, and there were like six new companies that I heard about. And there's like a couple a month, at least, I think, of different forms. And so it took a little bit to get going. And you know, Chad had to go out a little bit and do a lot of educating and convincing to get stuff started. And so when I met him, he'd gotten a little bit of that going. He'd gone through Y Combinator, had some ideas of the first kinds of systems that we wanted to build, and maybe how to get a company started that could actually raise enough capital to get off the ground. And so I started working with him while writing up, actually, doing some consulting work on some different things. And mm-hmm. and then came out, and we were kind of the first 10 of us here in Berkeley. We had an empty warehouse and a dill fridge and some MATLAB scripts from somebody's PhD. And sort of started on the journey.
And things have kind of picked up a hell of a lot in the last year, 18 months, 2 years, hasn't it? Your staff numbers have actually, from the last time I looked at your website, have actually quite exploded.
Yeah, well, it's all relative in Silicon Valley, right? But
sure.
We've been able, really, the vision, and this is what, you know, people ask, like, well, what attracted you to go do this, and how did you know that this was an approach you were into? There were sort of two things at the time, and the first thing was the idea to go full stack. We didn't come up with that word full stack, I think, maybe until we started writing our Series A pitch deck. The idea that to make a useful quantum computer, you needed to be looking at the full integration challenge. You needed to at least have hardware and software working together in some aspect. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just make an experiment or a machine and hand it off to people and say, you know, good luck. And there's history. There's a lot of history in technology of people trying that and it not going so well. And so that was appealing because, one, I thought it was being full stack and doing hardware and software together and coupling these things to try and get from zero to one was the most effective path. And then two, you have this opportunity to see the entire computing ecosystem like under one roof in some way. So, you know, at Rigetti, we write our own design software, we fab chips, we cool them in the fridges, we have control electronics that we work on and build to calibrate them, we hook them up onto an instruction set that we invented and wrote that I worked on a lot into a cloud programming environment that is then delivered that people run on. And that's like the classical computer industry is that whole stack, and we have a small microcosm of that for quantum computing in one company. And so the chance to be part of that and see that and help build that out was just a pretty incredible opportunity. The second aspect was that Chad and I very early on shared the vision that we wanted people to be able to access these machines. I think it was early on in one of the first dinners. We should put a quantum computer online and give it away for free, right? To like let people start to use it, to let people research it, and do this in an open way. And we followed up on that as well. So we've released our instruction set is open. We've released a lot of open source software. The 19 qubit chip that we have available now is free to use. You get time based on the merit of the idea that you want to use it for. This won't continue forever because it is expensive to build things. But that's a value that we share, and I was just telling you, we're giving 19 talks at Merch Meeting. We talk a lot about our technology, and that's because we're all fighting nature to make useful quantum computers, and we're kind of all in it together. So being open, kind of opens the doors to come up with good ideas quickly. Those are two things: the full stack aspect of it, and which we've also built out, which is now we're around 100 people now in Berkeley. We have a few facilities. We have a fab. We kind of have stitched all up the kind of backbone of the industry to get things going, and then also the chance to open things up. And those were the things that attracted me initially. And while we're not in any way done, now with almost 3 years later, we've got those two pieces in place, which is that's been a really rewarding thing for me to be part of.
So, I mean, obviously you're the head of quantum cloud services. So we'll talk about that in a second, but I just wanted to to just talk a little bit about the actual hardware platform. So you guys are superconducting qubits. People who are listening would be aware of the other two major superconducting efforts in the private sector side, which is obviously IBM and Google. I suppose, first of all, is there any sort of qualitative differences between the qubits that you three guys are basically pursuing? Or are you sort of, in a broad sense, pursuing effectively the same kind of qubits, and therefore the work that you see from Rigetti or IBM or Google and the software platforms that you're developing for this, do they end up being somewhat complementary to each other and possibly systems that can be integrated together, maybe further down the line?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting questions in there. So first off, we're all using transmons, right? So they're all and we've looked at other architectures too. We have and so everyone's also looking at different kinds of tunable couplers or fluxoniums or other different kinds of ideas. But there is kind of a base shared technology layer there, and that means we face a lot of the same problems at the same time. Like one of the big ones now is the 3D signal integration. Though I will say that might elide some of the differences, which is that it's kind of like saying everybody's working with transistors. But that doesn't mean our chips are all the same. We make different trade-offs. So, for example, a lot of IBM's chips are all fixed frequency transmons, and they use a particular kind of gate scheme because of that. Google has these tunable couplers, and we have sort of an alternating. We have fixed qubits and tunable qubits, and we use a particular kind of two-qubit gate called this parametric gate that we released an interesting theory paper on this summer. A lot of the base stuff is similar. It's the kind of the same modality, and we kind of, as the technology moves, we're all kind of facing the same high level problems. But the different trade-offs you make in your design, in your connectivity, and in your layout, and in your fab matter. So let me see. I don't know if I answered all of the questions you had. There was one other question about how you might integrate them later.
It was, yeah. I mean, I don't know if anyone's really discussing it at this stage, simply because, we're not there yet, in terms of the technology. But certainly, if we're talking in the future, a more sort of global ecosystem where, let's be realistic here, there are going to be multiple players within the hardware space,
Oh,
all
yeah,
building quantum
absolutely.
computers and stuff like that. In terms of interconnectability and the ability to expand an ecosystem, the fact that Rigetti, IBM, and Google are working on the same major platforms, I imagine, would make that kind of, more futuristic vision of what quantum technology could turn into, a little more practical when it comes to the engineering side.
Yeah, I think over time we're going to differentiate more and more, or at least the product lines will have to differentiate. Like right now, everybody's building a big hunk of qubits and running gates on them. Like there's no von Neumann architecture for quantum computers. I mean, eventually we're going to have to start making those decisions. Another aspect of this, and this is one that, and this is another differentiator, I think, from how some other people talk about systems, is that we really treat our quantum computers not as just the chip. It's not just about the quantum memory. It is about the whole system. And a whole quantum computer is classical compute plus quantum compute. When you look at the thing in the lab, you've got a dilution refrigerator with a quantum chip at the bottom, but you've also got this control rack with FPGAs and CPUs, and you can hook it up to other things. And so to look at the whole compute resource, you need to take into account a hybrid model, a quantum classical hybrid model. And so for us, very, very early on, the quantum classical hybrid nature of these near-term algorithms, these near-term applicable algorithms, like the variational quantum eigensolver, like the quantum approximate optimization algorithm, those were hybrid. And so we, from the ground up, started to build our systems to target a hybrid quantum classical setup. So that includes, not just the chip, but also the racks. And that led to one of the things that I've had the most fun putting together while here, which is the QuIL instruction set architecture. It's called the QuIL for Quantum Instruction Language. And it's worth talking about because I think there's a lot of formats for talking about quantum circuits, but QuIL is not just another chasm. It's not just another quantum circuit description language. It's actually a very opinionated model about quantum computing, which is that it's not just about the quantum memory. It has a piece of quantum memory and a piece of classical memory, and the instructions address both. and they're about how they interact with each other. And there are things that you can do in Quill that you can't represent in quantum circuits. For example, you can parameterize the rotation angle of an RX gate by giving some set of classical bits in the shared classical memory. And that seems like, okay, well, why would you want to do that? Okay, well, now think, well, what if those bits are themselves set by some measurement that I took somewhere else in the circuit, and I fed forward, and I did some classical computation on that, and then I fed forward an answer, and then I determined the angle of a rotation gate that happens later. And that's the kind of thing that people talk about as classical control. Like we've talked about, you know, people talked about classical control with quantum computing for a long time, but we tended not to formalize that as well as we would formalize the quantum circuits. Like, you know, we draw these double lines
Let's just pull back a little bit, because these kind of conversations we haven't had on the podcast before. So let's maybe we can have a bit more of a higher level sort of chat about what we're talking about in this context, because you're right, there are a whole bunch of quantum programming languages that are being developed, that have been released, that, as you mentioned, it's not just writing a quantum circuit. There is active feed forward control that exists within a quantum circuit. I do a measurement here, that measurement influences what I have to do later in the quantum processing, or the answer might get fed to a classical processor completely, and then the classical processor does some stuff, and then a new quantum algorithm is formed based on the output of the classical processor. So let's just talk a little bit about this sort of hybrid sort of co-processing model that you're talking about, and then let's talk about the specifics again of what you guys are developing to actually encapsulate that sort of hybrid quantum classical interface.
Yeah. So the first main thing to mention is that this is totally fundamental for doing any kind of quantum error correction. Mm-hmm. This is how quantum error correction works, right? You make some syndrome measurements and you get some measurement outcomes, and then you decide how to correct, and you've got to do that pretty fast. But there are other areas where this kind of feed-forward and feedback classical control stuff plays in. So a couple highlights are, it happens in teleportation. So in the like most basic example that you see in textbooks, and that's an indicator that it's very fundamental. But also there have been these repeat until success circuits, these kind of post-selected ideas, which come up. It's kind of similar to the sort of post-selection you have to do in magic state distillation in some ways. But you can apply, they've been applied to enhance compilation. So if you can do these, so the idea is you apply some quantum instructions, you measure and post-select on the outcome. And if the outcome is a one, then you proceed. And if the outcome is a zero, then you repeat what you just did. And you might have like an undo computation step in there as well. Mm-hmm. But this is sort of a trick that lets you do things that are sort of non-unitary operations. They let you compile in some ways. There was a recent paper by Alanis Buruguzic's group in how you could apply these to do something called a quantum neuron, sort of do the sigmoid, the non-linearity in a quantum neural network. I think it's a way of programming that is going to become more and more interesting to people when it becomes available. And when we start to realize we need to squeeze as much as possible out of these near-term devices. So we want to give you as much classical compute to work with to try and get performance out of the QPU.
Right. So this is how PyQuil, as you were saying, gets into this, that you are building it with respect to these quantum classical sort of handoffs and processing that has to go on in both systems. We can also talk about PyQuil in relation to your latest releases, which is the Forest platform.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So
how do they, are they two separate things? Is PyQuil part of Forest? I mean, give us a framework for the software side of what you guys are doing.
Yeah, so we make a bunch of stuff. So I get this question a lot. So we make hardware, and then we hook it up to the cloud and have a quantum programming development environment called Forest. And Forest is the whole development environment, which right now includes an instruction set architecture, this one mm-hmm. called Quill, which is basically the input to the hardware that talks about the shared memory implementation. It includes a simulator, so a classical simulation of a quantum computer that's called the quantum virtual machine. That also takes Quill. It lets you define noise models. It's very powerful. I can talk more about that. And then there's an API. Then so actually you interact with Forest over a cloud API that you can authenticate through. And then there's some client side libraries. And there's actually a bunch in a bunch of different languages. The core one is a Python library called PyQuil, which is free. It's Apache 2. It's on GitHub, open sourced. Mm-hmm. And it's basically Python code that lets you write Quill programs and send them through the API to run on either the simulator or on our QPUs. And so we released this past December access to Forest with our 19-qubit processor called Acorn, the 19-qubit mm-hmm. Acorn processor. And so people over the last few months have been using the Forest development environment to run programs and to and execute things on the simulator and the QPU. And so on the client side, we also have not just the PyQuil library to development, but also a lot other libraries that have example algorithms. There's implementations of hybrid algorithms like VQA and QAOA as examples. Somebody on a hack week, I think, wrote, not Arrighetti, wrote like a JavaScript JS Quill, in case you need that. There's one in OCaml. There's a Lisp one. There's also, we hook up to Open Fermion, which is a very cool open source package that several academic groups, us, Google, have contributed to, which is doing electronic structure, for doing quantum chemistry. Mm-hmm. There's a Forest backend to that, so you can hook up Open Fermion to Forest. To summarize, sort of Forest is the whole ecosystem of what's a lot of pieces of software that let you develop quantum programs and test them and then execute them on our hardware. The overarching there's sort of two overarching principles to Forest that are worth mentioning. And the first is that it's easy. And so that's why it's in Python and you can pip install it and there's pretty good tutorials. And it's particularly very easy to switch between the real hardware and the simulator. That's like one line or two lines of Python that you change. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you know, you have to target the right gate set and the simulator's perfect qubits and the QPU has noise. And so, you know, you have to deal with that. But from a programmatic aspect, it's super easy. And the second one is that it's hybrid. And that's what we've been talking about, that it's this shared memory model where there's this classical compute and quantum compute and you target both of them. So Forest is our easy hybrid quantum cloud development environment.
This hybrid environment that you do have, as you said, you've got the simulator that runs sort of on perfect qubits and just lets you test things out. And then you've got the actual 19-qubit chip, which people can get access to. This is similar to what exists from IBM, and I think Google's going to do a similar thing this year and launch access to their devices. But give us a bit of a flavor on whether or not people have engaged with the 19-qubit chip. Have they done anything that we haven't seen before yet, especially because I think, were you guys the first at that size? I can't remember.
We were, I think IBM very closely got the 19-20 qubit scale up at around the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's good. I mean, we they've been doing quantum computing for 20 years. We made our first qubit 2 years ago. Like we're doing okay.
Yeah.
and I've been really impressed with what people have done so far. I mean, we still have a long way to go on improving the fidelities, of our systems, but we wanted to get something up and early because we thought we might be surprised. And we have been.
Has there been a lot of stuff done? I mean, I know people love playing around with it. We had James Wooten on the podcast sometime about a year and a half ago, that he's gotten really into this sort of programming quantum games to run on quantum computers and stuff like that. Have you had any interesting applications that have been developed by people who are integrating with your QPU?
Yeah, I'll talk about a couple, and there's even more in the pipeline. So one is James himself has written and run some stuff. He's got his quantum awesomeness game, this benchmarking game that he's written and run on there, which is fun. And then there's someone else in the community is working on. I don't want to steal his thunder, but like it's related to music, like a way to like kind of generate music by playing quantum circuits in this like mm-hmm. cool way, and like different hackathon projects are cool. And then on the science side, there's several different things people have used. There was a group out of Canada, this startup that was training Bolson machines on the simulator side of Forest, and they're working to do that on the QPU now. About a month after we put it up, a group at Oak Ridge National Labs altered the variational quantum eigensolver, which is usually used for the electronic structure of molecules, to do nuclear structure of deuteron. And they ran that on both the IBM chip and also on our 19-qubit chip. And you know, they got the right answer, which I think is the stage that's the stage we're at in quantum computing, right? Like, do the smallest example and like it did work.
Has anyone been running like competitions? I remember there was a paper, I think Chris Monroe's group did it, where they were pitting their iron trap machine up against the quantum experience from IBM. Has anyone sort of started playing around with that, sort of running you guys off on a competition as to speed and fidelity and
yeah, I know like I know like a half a dozen to a dozen groups who are like kind of writing those papers and taking that data like now, mm-hmm. right now. so look to see more of that, and we really encourage that. You know, this is fun. You know, like it's all testing it all out. So in that Oak Ridge paper, they actually did that. They kind of did that comparison, and they saw that, you know, IBM's chip has somewhat higher fidelities than ours on at least the 2-qubit fidelities right now. And that mattered in some of the plots, but in terms of getting the final answer, it actually mattered less than it might seem to. Mm-hmm. They actually, with taking less data, were able to get a slightly more accurate answer using our 19-qubit chip. So I think, and there's other examples of things that people are coming out, and we're looking forward to the those papers, and really think that, like, we want to provide, you know, we want to provide the chip to people who, you know, not everyone has a quantum computer in their backyard. And there's tons of low-hanging fruit and research that can be done to study the system, you know, either as a well-controlled quantum state, which is in and of itself fascinating from like a condensed matter physics perspective, or as a novel kind of computation from a computer science perspective. People are testing, you know, just how to do compilation better under noise. Like, they're trying to write compilers. You know, they're trying to write that stuff. And so we want to make it available to support that kind of thing. And then what we ask for is feedback. Like, help us make it better. Tell us what's wrong. Help us solve it.
I think that's a very, very good approach. I suppose we're going to wrap things up in a little bit because we're both up against a hard deadline. But I just wanted to finish off this podcast by asking you, where do you see what's happening at Rigetti going, or where do you hope it can go over the next 5 years? And I just want to put something to you that Rod Van Meter in Japan likes to say at the end of his talks in regards to quantum computing development. And the idea is, well, when do we see the first scientific paper that uses a quantum computer to do something interesting? And the paper has nothing to do with the quantum computer in which the result was calculated on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really, really good milestone. I will edit that slightly. So I like what he says from, you know, my science background. I'm mm-hmm. you know, I'm a scientist like you, Simon. But we think about it a little bit more generally, which is, when is a quantum computer going to solve a scientific or business problem? Really a business problem, where nobody cares that it's a quantum computer. They care about that outcome.
Yeah.
That's where we're trying to go with Rigetti. You know, we're trying to, you know, we love this technology, we love quantum computing. However, it's really, the success of it is measured by, you know, are we solving people's problems? Are we solving some of the most, are we using quantum computing to solve some of the most important problems in the world? And that's the hope that we all have for the technology. And that's what we're steering towards. I mean, we know it's going to take a long time. Like, you know, the lab is right over there, and like, I know how noisy the chips are.
Right.
but we're not going to shy away from that as what we want to do. We want to solve valuable and useful business applications. And the reason for that is that, you know, the business value is a proxy for how much this helps people, right? If people are willing to pay for it, then it's really helping them do things.
So one last thing. I mean, obviously, you guys are doing a hell of a lot, especially on the software side, in terms of outreach, trying to open source a lot of this stuff and trying to engage both the quantum computing community and just the classical computing community as well. So is there anything coming up that you want to spruik, anything you want to advertise for that's happening anywhere in relation to Rigetti?
Absolutely. So we just actually earlier today put online announcing we're hosting our first hackathon that we've ever hosted. It's going to be April 6th and 7th here in the Bay Area, right by the Quantum Data Center. And there's 50 or 60, it's kind of a limited number of participants, but if you go to rigetti.com/hackathon, you can check it out there and sign up. All of our tools will be available. The QPUs will be available. James Wooten will be there. we have a great panel of of judges. John Morton from UCL will be there. Gwen Pomirovad-Mojo, my colleague, will be on the panel. Zavin Dar, a VC who's been investing in some quantum stuff in the Bay, will be here to make it kind of fun on the judging panel. And we're going to see what we can build. So I would really encourage people to come on by and we're going to host more of these. So even if you can't, check out Forest. It's just at forest.rigetti.com. And then there's a Slack channel where we discuss all sorts of stuff about Forest, about quantum computing. You can ask any question and you'll get answers from some real experts pretty quick. And that's just at slack.rigetti.com. So I hope to see more people there.
Wonderful. Well, thanks a lot, Will, for coming on the podcast today and sparing me 40 minutes of your time. And I wish the whole team the best of luck, and very interested to see what you guys come up with this year.
Thanks a lot, Simon. It's great to be here. I'm glad you're doing this.
No problem. So thanks again, everyone, for joining me today. I've actually got a few more guests lined up for the next couple of weeks. So fingers crossed, I should be able to be putting out episodes at least once every week, every 2 weeks. So please subscribe to us on iTunes, check out our Twitter feed to keep up to date with the podcasts as they come out. So thanks again, and thanks, Will.